The Bridge by Dave Baldwin.
It was a quiet evening and there wasn't much traffic about, so a car parked on the bridge seemed odd. Then he saw the chap sitting on the parapet with his feet over the edge. So he stopped just ahead of the parked car and got out.
That's a pretty bold thing to do. Did he recognise the chap?
No, he didn't recognise him. And Steve wouldn't think it bold at all. He's just a caring sort of bloke. He'd help anyone if he could. He just got out of the car and called out to the chap.
Are you okay? Are you all right? Has your car broken down? Are you waiting for someone? I'm going to come and sit with you. Is that okay? You've got a better head for heights than me. I get dizzy sitting on the edge like that. I think I'll just stay here. Is that okay? You've been here long?
What's that got to do with you?
Oh, nothing. Nothing. Just me being nosy, I guess. It's strange, isn't it? We all get curious about the unusual. I mean, I come past here every weekday on my way home, and I've never seen a car parked on the bridge. That's why I noticed you. Unusual, you see, so we get curious. At least I do. Perhaps I'm just naturally nosy. Yeah, that could be it, I suppose. Nosy, that's me. Mind you, I did do something very similar to this a couple of years ago. Yeah, a couple of years ago it was. It was on this very bridge. I parked my car in the lay-by back there and walked across. I ended up about here. Yeah, it might have been a bit further over, but it was round about here. Then I climbed over the railing and sat on the parapet, just like you're doing now. Yeah, come to think of it, I didn't feel at all dizzy then. That's strange, isn't it? I mean, just looking down there now is pretty daunting, but then I didn't feel dizzy or fearful at all. And it's not like I've grown out of it. I've never liked heights. Never. I suppose I had so much occupying my mind that nothing else mattered. Something like that, I suppose. Funny thing, the mind, isn't it? Complicated. Yeah, I sat on this parapet for a couple of hours, just looking at the water down below. I wasn't scared at all about the height. Strange, isn't it? Because when I look back at it now, I'm scared just to think about it. I mean, I could have fallen off this parapet easy as pie, straight into the murky depths of the River Medway. And I can't swim. Yeah, scares me now just to think about it. That would have been the end of me. No more life, no more choice. And I would have, if it hadn't been for a bloke called Martin Hall. Martin. My favourite name. Look, I'd had it tattooed on my wrist just in case I forgot it. Yeah, this chap spotted me as he drove over the bridge, so he parked up there at the end and walked back. He just climbed up and sat beside me. He said that he'd thought about jumping off the bridge, and he saw this as an opportunity not to die alone. He told me that he'd just had the result of a hospital scan and that he'd been diagnosed with terminal cancer. Well, I couldn't even bring myself to talk about my problems. They seemed so ridiculously trivial. I was the only person he'd told. He couldn't even bring himself to tell his wife. Well, that was his greatest worry, leaving his wife. Well, we must have talked for an hour. Then we went together to a pub and had a pint before going back to his place. I met his wife. We had dinner together and talked, just the three of us. Then Martin drove me back to my car and I came home. From that moment on, my life has been transformed. I now feel more positive and confident than I've ever felt. Far from wanting to end my life, I cling to it with a fierce sense of purpose and determination. When I think of all the good things that have happened to me since then, it scares me just to think about this bridge. I could have missed all of this. Oh, there have been bad things as well, of course, just like everybody else. But just thinking that I could have thrown it all away if I'd slipped that night, well, makes my blood run cold. I've made some bad mistakes in my life, but that would have been the worst. Yeah, the very worst. No more options. No more choices. Yeah, but my life was rubbish then. Just lurching along from one crisis to another. No job, no money, no home, no future, no ambition. Didn't seem to be much point in carrying on.
Yeah, now I get it.
Get what?
Why you're here. Sort of Samaritan. You're going to tell me that because you decided not to jump, you now live in a lovely house in a wonderful neighbourhood and you're holding down a great job as a counsellor to the disadvantaged.
Hey, that would be great. When do I start?
Okay. So what's changed?
Me?
And
nothing. I've got a very humble job, very little money, and I live in a tiny rented flat.
And you're happy?
Most of the time, yeah. Oh, we have our ups and downs, but who doesn't?
We?
Yes, we. I have a girlfriend. Well, I say girlfriend, but I suppose a lady of 46 can hardly be called a girl. Partner always makes it sound like a business arrangement, and fiancé has all sorts of implications. So, yeah, girlfriend. You married?
Was. Well, still am, technically. I mean, I'm not divorced or anything. We split up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I never married. Well, I never really found anyone who was daft enough to marry me. I was in the army for 12 years, moving round from camp to camp, country to country. Not a very attractive marriage proposition. Since leaving the army, I've been in and out of work, trying to settle, but no one seems to be in a hurry to employ an ex-squaddie. I've moved around the country looking to put roots down somewhere, but it hasn't been easy.
So, what's really changed for you?
Oh, me. Me. I used to be a bloke that things happened to. Someone who was always the victim. Poor old me. Look what's happened now. I don't deserve this.
And you don't feel like that now?
No, not at all. Not since that evening on this bridge. No, I felt so much more positive. I feel in control of my life. I feel a level of self-confidence that I hadn't even dreamed of. I began to realise that you can't just sit back and wait for life to deal you a winning hand. You've got to have the confidence to get out there and take life by the scruff of the neck. I realised that half of my problems would be solved by being able to share them.
No, I don't think sharing would solve my problems.
Well, it may not solve them, but it would bring support in the search for a solution. You'd be surprised how everything gets pulled into perspective by a bit of sharing. Go on, try it. Try it with me.
I don't even know you.
Well, no one will know you unless you trust them and talk to them. Come on, what are those problems?
Yeah, well, you won't see them as problems because you've been through them.
Oh, I can see just about anything as a problem. An insurmountable problem. What may be a mere trifle to some can become a total life-changing disaster when it's been bottled up and turned over in a tormented mind. Just let a little air in and then see it in a fresh light. Come on, shock me.
And so he did. Not shock him. No, Steve is difficult to shock. 12 years of active army service had made him pretty shockproof. No, this guy simply talked of all the problems and obstacles that he was up against that together made him feel totally hopeless. The final straw in a catalogue of problems was being made redundant from work that week. He felt completely alone and unwanted.
What about his wife? I know they'd split up, but she was surely someone he could talk to.
She'd apparently gone back to live with her mother in Liverpool. No, Steve could empathise with this chap. He certainly had a run of bad luck, and losing his job had just tipped him over the edge.
Surely he could have got himself another job. I mean, it may not have been as good as the job he'd had, but at least it would mean that he had some sort of income. I can see how depressing it would be to suddenly lose your job and your income, but it's not the end of your working life, and certainly no reason to end things.
Yes, it does sound a poor reason for taking your own life, doesn't it? I don't think it's simply a question of money. Few things are. Everything that happened to this guy was a rejection. His wife had rejected him as a husband and as a person. And now he's being rejected as an employee. He felt useless and unwanted. It had taken him many years to achieve the status of a husband and an employee, and now he'd been taken away. Did he really have the emotional energy and self-will to start again? A positive, outgoing, optimistic person would have. Some will almost look upon it as an opportunity. But not Simon. He was down and beaten, just wanted a way out.
So, what happened?
Something pretty remarkable.
Yeah, you haven't had a lot of luck lately, have you? And you feel like you haven't got a friend in the world. Tell you what, though. There are thousands, yes, literally thousands of people in this country alone who are suffering from potentially terminal diseases, who are fighting to stay alive. Every one of them would give everything they have to swap places with you, a physically fit and able man. Now, I know that doesn't help you, but if your life is the envy of so many, don't you think you ought perhaps to give it another chance? After all, you've got a friend now. What's to lose? Yeah?
Yeah. Okay.
Good man. The first step is to get off that parapet. On this side. I'm Steve. What's your name?
Simon.
Good to meet you, Simon. The first thing to do is follow me to my home. You can stay with us tonight, and tomorrow we'll sit down and make a plan of action. Things are going to be okay. Trust me. I know it.
That's the first problem. I can't follow you in that car. It isn't mine. I stole it from a Sainsbury's car park.
You stole it?
Well, I had a kind of company car. They took it back. Now I couldn't even get to this bridge. I've never stolen a thing in my life. But with my intentions, it would be first and last offence.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean. Well, we'll have to go in mine. How did you get into it?
It was open.
And how did you start it?
Keys were left in the ignition.
Oh. Well, it doesn't sound like you stole it. More like borrowed it. Come and get in my car. We'll leave them a note.
A note?
Yeah, we'll say where you borrowed it from, apologise, and leave a fiver for petrol.
Why?
Because the police will look through CCTV footage and identify you. Apologise now and save yourself further grief.
Oh, yes.
Come on.
So that's what they did.
They left the car there?
They left the car with a note, an apology, and a fiver. And they drove to Steve's flat, where Simon met Steve's partner, Angela. The three had dinner together and chatted till the small hours. Simon was a car salesman and attributed much of his lack of self-esteem to the nature of the job. It was a commission-based position with a meagre basic salary, which could only provide a living wage by employing sometimes aggressive sales tactics. The daily task of persuading customers to commit to sometimes dubious sales agreements for cars which they clearly couldn't afford gave Simon no job satisfaction or feeling of self-worth. Stephen sensed that Simon was just not suited to the cutthroat world of sales. They would look at other alternatives tomorrow.
Where does Steve work?
Oh, he works for a charity. It's part of the British Legion. They help ex-servicemen re-establish themselves in civilian life.
So he'd know a fair bit about getting a job, wouldn't he?
That's right. He knew all the agencies and likely employers for miles around. So the following morning he sat down with Simon, a notebook and a telephone, and organised three or four initial interviews.
What sort of jobs were they?
Well, between them, they decided that Simon's knowledge of cars and the motor trade could be a very positive asset. The jobs they targeted ranged from the sale of car spares and accessories to car hire and motor insurance claims handling. By the end of the day, they'd arranged three interviews, and Simon was much more positive than the man who'd sat on the parapet of that bridge. Steve drove him home that evening, and as they passed over the bridge, Simon remarked that it all seemed so long ago that they'd met. His world and his attitude to life had changed completely in just 24 hours. They reached Simon's house in about 15 minutes. He lived in a rented semi in a village on the south side of the bridge. Steve lived on the north side. They were almost neighbours. Simon collected some of his things, packed a case, and then returned to Steve's house. He could live with them until he gets settled.
He was so lucky to meet Steve. Not many people would be prepared to help to that extent.
Oh, I reckon there are more than you'd think. At least I'd like to hope so. The luck in this case lies in the fact that having been in the situation himself, Steve could understand Simon's despair. He was also in a position to help. Anyway, over the next 5 days, Simon was offered two jobs. He took one of them. He was now the manager of a shop selling motor spares to the general public and to the trade. A reasonable salary, a turnover bonus, and a small company car made up a package that gave him the platform for a new life.
So that intervention by Martin saved not just Steve's life, but Simon's as well.
I'd like to think that's the way it always works. Kindness breeds kindness. One thoughtful act can have an endless knock-on effect. Sadly, the same seems to be true of selfish and thoughtless acts. But the good people of this world just keep on trying. There are lots of them. They just don't get the publicity.
So did Steve keep contact with Simon?
Oh, yes. Regularly. They became great friends. Not just because of that special relationship between the two of them. They found they had so much in common. When the new, positive, optimistic Simon emerged, Steve could identify with this man and feel towards him like a brother. He too had spent some time in the army, and the two spent hours sharing reminiscences of service life. One evening, Simon pushed back his sleeve and revealed the name Stephen tattooed on his left wrist. Steve put his wrist next to it, joining his name with that of his hero, Martin. Simon made contact with his wife again, and after some weeks of long telephone calls to Liverpool, Sheila came back to their home in Cuxton. And the two couples began socialising together on a regular basis. Sheila was a friendly, outgoing person with an endless appetite for life. She and Simon seemed now like a couple made for each other. But it's easy to see that Simon of old, the Simon who sat on the parapet, would have been a poor match for this lively, sparky young woman.
So which came first? Simon's depression or Sheila's leaving him?
Oh, that's the old chicken and egg thing, isn't it? My guess is that it was a bit of both. I think she left just because he wasn't much fun to be with, and he fell into a deep depression once he'd gone. But whatever happened in the past, they seemed ecstatically happy now. She was the sort of girl who was endless fun. She just wanted everyone to be happy. There were times when a concern for others became something of an intrusion.
In what way?
Well, for instance, she was clearly concerned that Angela was a widow at a comparatively young age. But she never spoke of a situation or mentioned her late husband. Simon, fearing that this might be a delicate and emotional matter, had never broached the subject. But Sheila's curiosity got the better of her one evening.
You're very young to be widowed. Was it illness or an accident?
Hey, you can't ask that, love. I'm sorry, Angela. It is endless female curiosity.
Don't worry yourself over that, Simon. But that's all in the past, Sheila. Let's not think too much about what happened in the past. If there were lessons to be learned, we learned them at the time. If there were tears to be shed, we shed them then. Let's live in the present and look to the future. I'll just say that we parted in love. A love that is only matched by what I feel for this big, ugly fella.
So the matter was never mentioned again. The happy quartet became quite well known in the area. They seemed inseparable in the social scene, with regular visits together to the cinema, the theatre, pubs and restaurants. It was in a restaurant in Rochester one evening that the truth emerged.
The truth?
Yes. It was a Saturday evening and the place was full. They'd finished the meal and were drinking coffee and chatting when a man approached the table and spoke to Angela.
We must come here again. That duck was delicious.
Yes, wasn't it? We used to come here regularly when we lived just up the road.
Yes, we lived for a while with Sheila's mum on the Maidstone Road.
More coffee, anyone?
Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt your evening, but aren't you Angela Hall?
Yes, that's right. I don't think I know who you are.
I'm George Curtis. You probably don't remember me. We were in the same book club together some years ago.
Oh, yes, yes, of course. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Look, I don't want to interrupt your evening, but I just wanted to say how sorry I was to hear about Martin. We all were very, very sad. Our condolences.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Nice to see you.
Suddenly, what had been a lively, chatty evening between the four turned into awkward silence. Then, after an endless stream of inconsequential small talk, Angela spoke up.
You're probably now thinking that there can't be many Martin Halls, so I must be the wife of the Martin who saved Steve's life. Well, that's what I'd be thinking. And I'd be right. I was married to Martin, and because we never divorced, I think I'm still married to him. But Stephen is someone I love. And in a way, he was given to me by Martin.
We know that Martin was very ill, so...
No, you deserve to know the whole story. When Martin found Steve on the bridge, he brought him home to our house. We talked for hours, and then Martin drove Steve back to the other side of the bridge, where his car was parked. Steve then left to drive home. Martin drove back, stopped on the bridge, went to the parapet and jumped.
No!
The Bridge was a Bare Bones Theatre production with the following cast. John was played by Gordon Stewart. Sarah by Amanda Watkins. Stephen by Tony Hearn. Simon by Howard Jones. Angela by Margaret Baldwin. Sheila by Jeanette Bennett. And George Curtis by Dave Baldwin. Recording and production were by Dave Baldwin.